Oh yeah.
What are you working on over there, Ruit?
Oh, well, I mean, we got this show, right? And so I figured I would just come up with a random table of intros, like the tropes that we've done over the years, and just like have a random table of it, right?
Okay, yeah. So that sounds good. All right.
So yeah, I'll just read some entries off of it. So like, there's obviously the Jim and Pruitt writing and start a conversation trope.
Okay.
Yeah. Obviously the one I love the most, the Pruitt misinterprets the subject. Like that's a fan favorite, I think, also.
Okay.
Which leads me to the next entry, which is coffee tables. So there's that.
What? Okay. Why don't we just tell them what we were talking about? Like, what are we?
Well, entry four is the straightforward info dump. So I'm getting to that. So
all right.
Yeah.
What I feel like this has gone on way too long. Like, what is it that you've been working on for the intro, Pruitt? Come on.
We're getting there. So entry five on the random table is Jim and Pruitt argue, which we're here. And yeah, so that leads to entry six, which is the meta joke. So now that we've gone through my random table of intros, let's just finish the intro on random tables here on WebDM.
This week's episode is sponsored by Hero Forge, the masters of customizable miniatures.
If you've never played with their online 3D character creator, you are missing out. They've got so many options. You can make your character exactly the way you want it, and they come out looking great.
If you've got a 3D printer, you can download the specs, or they can cast them for you and send them straight to you. Color printing is available now. Just check out this mini that they sent us.
Go to heroforge.com to start designing your custom miniatures today. Link in the comments and description.
Okay, here, Jim. Now, as folks may have noticed by the title of this episode, we've covered this subject before, but I think that in a random chaotic world, it is quite all right to hit on a result again, even though it might be slightly different.
Certainly.
Jim, we're talking about random tables today. So why are we talking about random tables today?
Yeah, today we're getting into the nitty-gritty of writing your own random tables, building out your DM's toolkit. So this is kind of a high-concept show where we're building on our previous two episodes about random tables, one of them in defense of random tables from 923-15, like way back in the day, and then random encounter tables in RPGs from 10-10-18, which really delves into like the encounter part of random tables, like building out combat and things like that from them. So we're sort of assuming that you want to make better use of random tables in your games and that you like already know the basics of their use. If that's not the case, then please go back and rewatch those other two for a bit more context, but they're not like necessary or anything.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is a game of dice, and dice are the harbingers of chance. And so how you want to mold that chance is kind of the first question you have to ask yourself, right? Like, what percentage do you, how many outcomes do you want, and what percentage do you want of those? Yep. And so, I mean, I think die size, you know, die size matters here.
I think that the general assumption or this was certainly my case, was like the bigger the better, D100 or go bust. And like, that's not necessarily the case. And before we like really dig into it, this is where the website AnyDice is like great. it will tell you all kinds of probability curves or probability distributions. Sorry, I'm not a mathematician, although we are going to get into a bit of that in the episode. But
I love the D4, D12 table.
Right. Yes, for those 2 through 16 results that you might need. But you might, like, you know, who knows?
With a really weird curve.
Really weird. But yeah, any dice will tell you all kinds of what the probability distributions are, what the curve actually is, depending on if you're using multiple dice. It'll show you all kinds of different ways to visualize it and the like. So that's sort of like my go-to for what I want out of a table. But that's one thing. We're talking about like actual die size itself. I really stick to four types depending on what I want out of a table. And like, hands down, my favorite, the unsung workhorse of the dice bag, the D6, right?
Well, it ain't just pretty for Vegas. I mean, it's very important to D&D as well, or just any role-playing game. But yeah, because seriously, if you just need to come up with a random table for something for your game today, are you really going to need more than six entries?
Probably not. You're probably not even going to need six, but six is a good number.
That's the thing. You're not even going to need six.
Yeah.
So, like, one can be a null result, meaning, like, nothing happens.
Sure.
And you only need five things. But, yeah, I'm right there with you, man. I love a good D6 table.
Yeah, yeah. So, the thing that I really appreciate it is that the probabilities break down to, like, little under 17%. It's, like, 16.66 or something. I'm not really sure. I've even forgotten from when I looked this up earlier. So it's approximately 17% chunks. And to me, that's like a good chunky possibility, right? A 1 in 6 chance. Yeah, I mean, that's not great, but it's still going to come up often enough that you're going to see it. And then for me, it's like very easy to break down and sort of visualize what the rest of that is. So 1 through 2 is like a 33% chance, right? And then 1 through 3, that's 50%. And so it's just I find it's a very elegant way to break things down and to, provide yourself with enough variation that it feels like you're actually rolling something random, but it's not so granular that it's like, oh, I've like never gotten this result that I put on there that I was really hoping to get. And so I like for actually using something in session, D6 is what I rely on the most. And so the way I'd use it, like a lot of the times is to come up with a, you know, a list of six encounters or something that, that I want for that session or that I think would be appropriate for what I know we are going to do for that session. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if they go left where I thought they'd go right, that's something else, and I'll save those for later. But to come up with a list of six very detailed, very appropriate encounters for what's going on, not that difficult. And then if you leave sort of blank spots in there, determine like the who, the what, the why, but not necessarily the where, for instance, you can like slip them in when they seem appropriate for that time, or you can like roll on the table if you want. That's the other thing. You don't have to roll on these, but you have arranged them in such a way that if you can, or if you want to, it's very easy to. And that since I've given myself that bit of surprise for myself, you know, that keep me on my toes, reason for using random tables in the first place, or one of them. But I haven't like rolled on something that's completely disconnected from what's going on, and then I've got to do a bunch of mental gymnastics to fit it in that moment. Sometimes that's fun, but I don't always want that, you know?
Oh, no, I'm right there with you, man. Because like you were saying, like, you know, when you have those entries that never come up, but you really want them to, like, those are the points where you can make a table, but you don't necessarily have to use it. If you want something to come up, then it should just come up,
sure,
right? But I find that since we've talked about random tables so much, usually when I'm doing writing out DM info, that I will write in chunks of either 6 or 8 or 10 or 12, like just so that if I want a little randomness, I can just roll whatever the appropriate die and give it just a touch of random.
Yeah.
Because like you said, it's the spice, of life, and we should let it flow.
This applies to sort of a lot of my campaign prep. Like if I'm thinking up NPCs, I'm going to think up 6 of them. If I'm thinking up locations that I want to feature in the campaign, even before like the first session, I'm going to think up probably 6 of them. Like combat, every place they go, I'm going to think of 6 different things that could happen there and what's going to be interesting about them and make them stand out. So that's why I kind of start here.
But Jim, sometimes the D6 isn't enough.
Sometimes
you need a little bit more. What's your next go-to?
Sometimes you do. D12, baby. It's the D6, but twice the fun.
Right. And it's almost like a 2D6 table also.
Almost, right? Almost. Yeah, I skip the D8 and D10. I'm if they work for you, they work for you. Not gonna tell you to stop using them. But for me, I find that it's either if I want more than six, I'm gonna want more than eight or ten as well. And the D12 mm-hmm. I like because of the distribution as well. And so it's got like 8.33% chunks, which is, you know, half of what you'd get with the D6. And like you mentioned, Pruitt, it's only one away or one more than a 2D6 table. So like creating a table that's D12 entries with number one being optional means I have a very easy way of determining, like, mm-hmm. do I want this to be like a bell distribution, or do I want more flat distribution? But what am I looking for in this moment? And like constructing them with the extremes at 2 and 12 and whatever, it gives me those options. And also, I like rolling D12s. Like, I never get to. And any chance I have to roll one, I will take it.
That's why you always play those barbarians in one shot, so you can roll a D12 for the hit points. So.
It is why I always play barbarians, so I get those D12 hit dice. But mostly I like it because it is like a D6, but twice the fun. And it helps me mm-hmm. sort of think about, okay, do I want this to be not a full one pip on a D6, but maybe, you know, still relevant enough to come up. 8.3 something is close enough to 10% that I'm satisfied with it. And I just find it versatile. Yeah, a couple more options. So like an example of how I differentiate between the two of them. You know, you're rolling through the wilderness. I know that they're going to be on the swamp road for the next session or two, and I have an idea of what monsters live there and the like. I'm going to prep that D6 table with six detailed encounters that are appropriate for that moment. But then when they get to the big city that's at the end of the swamp road, and I know they're going to be staying there for a long time, they've expressed interest in camping out at the city and the like, then the D12 is going to be more appropriate because I know I'm going to be rolling on this table more often.
Yeah.
And so I want enough entries that it keeps things fresh and the like. But if I have to come up, if I have to like start replacing entries on it, it's not going to be too, I don't know what you call it, too difficult to start coming up with new ones, you know?
Well, and what I like in your, like, you're just using your analogy of like being in a town, if you have your D12 table, like if it's a town where one of the players maybe knows their way around, you could switch that to a 2D6 table and put the safer, less deadly things right in the middle of the bell curve. So they might get those more often because it represents their knowledge of the town versus they're going into a brand new town. Anything could happen. Well, now we're rolling on a D12. Every option is equally applicable.
Yeah. It's a good way to model that kind of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The other two dice that I really to use, D20. The old standby, right? Oh. Probably got a lot of these lying around somewhere.
Oh, of course. You got D20 tables out the wazoo. I mean, you know, it's who doesn't love to roll a good D20? I mean,
certainly,
if you like
right,
rolling a D12, it's got more sides.
It does. It's got more sides. And, you know, the 5% chunks that it's in.
It's deep. Yeah.
Chunk is a mathematical term in this sense. It produces good results. You know, and if you've got a lot of things you're going to roll on, if you've got a table you're going to roll on a lot, a D20 table can be really nice for that because it still provides a lot of variability and a lot of randomness, but it doesn't require too much on the DM's part of like coming up with entries for everything. And there's a lot of ways to like split up a D20 table. You could do like a D8 plus a D12, which I think we got into in our last show on random encounters. So it gives you some options for that. And it's just like I said, you probably got a D20 right at hand. Roll it. There you go. So D20 tables I might use are like random combat events or like a critical hit or fumble chart or something like that, where it's like this table is going to get rolled on a lot, but I don't need like so much uniqueness to it that I would want to create a D100 table, you know?
Right. I mean, you could still use 2D10 for your D20 table if you wanted to create a bell curve, right?
You certainly can.
Or you could use your 2D10 for a D100 table, like you said.
Sure. You certainly can.
And that's number 100 on the D100 segue list.
The Magnificent Bastard. The D100. Right.
Yes. Oh, it's one of my favorite. Coming at, like, I've never done a full D100 table myself. Full disclosure, I've started many and have always just fizzled out, like, I think around 60-something. Sure. And then it's just like, this is crap, and, you know, whatever. But yeah, I love a good D100 table.
Who doesn't, right? Like, you're taking things in 1% sort of chunks. Although it is worth noting that because of the way that the D20 and the D100 table sort of interact with each other, if you don't have that many entries, maybe you're just making a D20 table and not really thinking of it like that. But I find the D100 tables are good for, like, prep style tables, where it's like, I don't know that I want to, like, honestly, there's a lot of times it's DM where, like, I just don't want to have to choose, you know, I'll just roll randomly because it helps to create those sort of constraints that are going to fuel my, you know, creativity. So, like, prep tables, I like a D100 for, or something where I want lots of variety across an entire campaign. Classic example being like a wild search table. You know, it's like, this thing's going to get rolled on a lot. It's not specific to any one part of this campaign. And like, it could easily, you know, benefit from having a lot of entries for it. When you run into sort of the issue you were talking about of just, like, you fizzle out after a while, I think understanding that a D100 table doesn't need to be filled in all at once, like, this is something you work on and kind of come back to. And also the trick that I found is, like, breaking it down into 10 D10 tables, right? So, like, I want 10 entries on this, 10 entries on that, et cetera, until you have a full, you know, full 100 entries. And
that goddamn brain, you know, of yours, Jim.
I think I'm pretty sure I picked that trick up.
It's like, like, duh. Like, duh. Like, why wouldn't you do that?
I think I ordered like 5 D20 tables or something. But just make it easier on yourself because, if you're trying to go through, like, you know, an exhaustive, I'm going to knock this out in one go, like, 100 interesting things is difficult. You know, it's not like that, you know, if you can't do it, you're lacking in creativity. It's just give your brain a break, you know. So understanding that something like a D100 table, you don't have to fill it out all at once, that's going to make it a lot more useful for you because, like, as long as you have enough entries, you can start using it earlier than when you might have it completed. Mm-hmm. And you just sort of like, oh, I only have 30 entries. So it's either I've got a D30, which you should, because D30 is awesome, or, you know, you're rolling
Dungeon Crawl Classics, just get it.
I don't like using them in play. I don't like having, especially if it's like an encounter table type thing, because I find them just unwieldy and not very useful in that sense. Either because like they take up more than one page in a rule book or typed out or something, and therefore I can't just look at a glance and see what all's there. Or because it's like, all right, I rolled 78, where is that on my chart? You know, it's just sort of difficult to use in play. Doesn't mean you never use it. There are situations where it might be useful. But for the most part, I would rather use a D12 or D6 table taken from a D100 table, either that I just, you know, look at or roll on and then create, like, detailed entries. Another way to use it is just not roll on it. Just go 1, 2, 3, 4. Like, you just arrange them in order and just read off the next one. Although that kind of defeats the point of having it be random. So, yeah, that's a trick you can use.
Yeah, but talking about these, you know, do you roll on your D100 or is it, you know, something broken down for more of a curve? I touched on it earlier and we've talked about it before many times. So talking about that single, you know, like, probability versus a more of a curve, let's delve into that. Let's see how many entries we can hit on
certainly,
this.
Certainly, certainly. So number of dice, that's what we're talking about here, right? Yeah. And you might see in your internet perusal of RPG topics, the D20 referred to as swingy. It's a very swingy dice. And
Well, you roll it when you swing to hit something.
Certainly. Sure, yeah. That's what I, for years, that's what I thought it meant. Like, literally for years. I was like, yeah, I guess it is swingy because I use it to hit things when I swing. But what they're referring to is that flat distribution, right? It's the fact that each possible result is equal to the other because you're just doing the one die, right? And you usually see it as like, oh, this is terrible. Oh, you shouldn't. The swinginess. Mm. And it's like, wait a minute. That's the point of using it. You know, it's a feature, not a bug. And there are plenty of situations where you want there to be an equal chance of everything happening because a reliable middle, right? The middle portion of those, you know, the bell curves, that could be really boring. You know, that can produce a lot of samey results. Another example of this is like the 2d6 reaction roll table. We've mentioned this a lot in different kinds of shows of having, you know, this sort of roll this die to see what the monsters think, whatever. And criticism of that is that the 6 through 8 entry, the most likely outcome, is neutral. Nothing happens. Standoff. Yeah. You know, both parties just kind of look at each other and go their separate ways. And there's some of that that can be mitigated with like DM skill, things like that, player choice. The fact that that comes up the majority of the time might be a problem, right? You might not want to have to constantly do that, you know, constantly mitigate for it.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about before is when you just, you know, throw in a D8 instead of a D6 on one of those. So it bumps up the chances of a higher result to change it. I don't know.
Yeah. That's also why I keep a D12 handy. But that's what we're talking about when we say, like, avoiding that boring middle. Now, some of that can be, you know, how you construct the tables, things like that. But if you're thinking, how many dice do I want to roll on this chart? And is it in, are you using it for play? Are you using it for prep? This is something to consider. Because maybe you do want to roll multiple dice, right?
Well, yeah. Because having that kind of middle ground to you know, rest on is what you want. Maybe.
Yes. Yeah.
You want something a little bit more stable as a result.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Like you mentioned earlier, you know, you're going to use something with multiple dice because that represents a reliability that comes through familiarity. You know, so if you're if you've got a chart of like random encounters through the city, my rogue knows, you know, about this place. When they roll on this, we're going to use 2 dice. When anybody else does, we're going to roll on, you know, with just 1 die. And that's the kind of, that's the sort of trick that you can use when constructing the table, like the order you put things in, to help you out with that. But the real question here is, when you're rolling multiple dice, is do I want one result to come up more often, right? Or or do I want it to, you know, to come up less often, you know? If you're doing something like an encounter table, maybe you put the really rare creatures at the ends of that curve. That, you know, thinking of 2d6 still, you know, your 2s and your 12s are the big monsters, you know, the boss types who are maybe not always out of their lair, but they could be. And that smaller chance represents the fact that they might be out, but they might not. But more than likely, you're going to run into the foot soldiers or whatever, you know.
Oh, most definitely. And what I like to do is the 2 is bad. If you get that, it's a tough fight, and there's not a lot of good about it. But if you get the 12, it's going to be a tough fight, but maybe you get more reward at the end of it. And that's usually how I spread mine out, usually.
Yeah.
Because I love the 2d6 and the 3d6 table.
I do. I mean, the 3d6 is one of those that I didn't really consider till I came across Hot Springs Island. And this is the product that I've really seen it used to good effect in, because the arrangement of entries on the encounter tables for Hot Springs Island are reflective of those sort of probabilities that are going to come up, the distribution of them. And so whether you're rolling on a table of beasts, you can start learning things about the environment you're in based on which entries come up a lot or more frequently. But then the whole premise of this is that there is a small island that you will repeatedly go to on multiple expeditions, some of them with the express purpose to scout out a place and get a feel for who lives there, so that you know where different lairs are, who's there, which faction controls which part of the island. And so when you're thinking of something like 3d6 or 5d4 or whatever, you know, however many you want, think about the benefits of it. It really benefits from the style of play where you keep visiting the same location over and over again, so that the way the probabilities are distributed becomes a strength of it and not a weakness. Mm-hmm. And because you're rolling on it a lot, the chance that the extremes of that are going to come into play is more likely, you know. So that's another thing to consider on how many dice you're going to roll on your random tables.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, and I've mentioned this. I'm pretty sure I mentioned this in the last show we did, or maybe I didn't. Maybe it was too long ago. Anyway, my 3d6 tables for my cipher game, Breath of the Fall, were explicitly probably actually from that last episode we did. But the way I arranged all of those encounters, where you worry about your like 10 and 11. Right in the middle of your 3d6, those are your obvious, and you do your extremes, and then I would just work my way towards the center with more likely encounters till you get to those things that happen all the time, and the probability divide on a 3d6 table is pretty insane when you look it up. It's pretty really, fun where you go from you swing from like 14% down to like 1.5% or less than 1% at the end.
The threes and 18s are less than 1%. And that's why any dice, right, that'll really help you.
Oh yeah, totally. But it's the same as rolling an 18 while rolling up a 3d6 character, like. That Certainly. Shit's going to be rare. And so, but when you hit those entries, it should be something to write home about for sure. And I know that that only happened like once or twice using my random encounter tables. And when it happened, it was a big deal. It was a big damn deal. That's what you get when using a table like that.
Yeah. And I think if I'm remembering correctly, that campaign was spent in pretty much the same location, visiting the various satellite areas of it.
Just descending. Yeah. Well, no, it was just descending an endless hole in the ground, or in the quote unquote ground. But it turned out being the nasal passage of a colossal beast. So it was there was some sameness about it, but it constantly changed. And once we got later on, I actually started using a slightly different dice to get the more extreme results on my encounter table, just to kind of show that things are getting a little weirder now. And so the weirdness will happen more often. I had a lot of fun with that, with those tables in that campaign.
Yeah, I recall having a lot of conversations with you about it. It seemed like you did get a lot out of the out of those tables.
Like Goldblum a lot.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for. You can also double up entries on those. You know, it doesn't have to be that every inch, like there's a three has this entry, a four has this entry. You could go like, all right, 3 through 7 is this, you know, so that you can play around with the entries in that way, so that you can get more of what you want, but still have a variable distribution.
Well, I did like pirates, and then a less likely instance would be the Pirate's Cove. And so that's how I kind of doubled up. You're still going to run into pirates at the Pirate Cove, but now you're actually in their base. And I did the same with like the cannibals that were everywhere, and then there were cults. And so each of those technically had two entries. More likely you'd run into a cannibal, less likely you'd run into a cannibal domicile, which, as the entry on the table said, you can stay for dinner, but it'll be your last meal. And so,
That's great.
I was proud of that.
Anyway. One, right. So I'd like to talk about one last sort of multiple die table that mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of when we filmed our last show on random tables, but have since become like really enamored with, and that is the D66 table. The D66 has 36 entries, I believe, and it goes from 11 to 66. And you read it exactly the same way you do a D100. One of them is the tens, one of them is the ones, right? And so it's got a good spread of entries. You've got the dice probably right there. And it provides enough variability that you're going to get a lot of that randomness, a lot of that, you know, what you're looking for in like not quite a D100, but you want more than a D20 table. It arranges nicely mm-hmm. into a grid, you know, so that you've got the six, you know, one through six on one, one through six on the other, and you kind of like have your entries all at one glance. It's just a fun kind of way of arranging things for a table for yourself. And because you can sort of group things together, like, okay, everything that's like, you know, 1, 12, 13, 14, up through 16, like that's all one type of encounter or entry, right? And that means you can then just roll a D6 on it if you want. You know, you don't have to do, you know, you don't have to roll two of them. But if you don't want to, you want the full range of the 36 entries, you roll the two dice. So D66 table is one of those that I've started to use a lot more in my games.
Jim, you've already, my mind is already blossoming with the column row like ways that you could possibly like arrange your entries so you can roll a D6 one way or the other way based on two variables, but they're all in the same like world. And I'm gonna try to just put that on the shelf because I'm already like background gold blooming, and so
right.
New tables coming up soon.
New tables, there you go. we've spent way longer on just like the dice than I thought we would, but I think it's good. Arranging these things, what is the layout of them, is something that's worth considering.
Oh, definitely
the nested subtable, right? Is one of those I think that you've used where you've got this like master table or the first table that you're rolling on, and then each entry generates its own subtable reference. And I like these. I like these for especially for prep, right? These are really handy. I've my favorite is the D100 nested table where it's like this thing's 40 something pages long because each entry that you roll on a D100 has its own separate table, and sometimes they're like two or three tables deep, you know. And
oh, it's insane.
This is for the big world building, the city state style, like the giant metropolis or something, where you want a lot of variability, and even within individual entries, you know, you don't want just a noble, for instance. You want to know what they're doing, who they've got with them, you know, what's going on with them, what do they want with the players, that kind of thing. So nested with subtables is good for like generating adventures or like detailed plot hooks, that kind of thing. And I'm a big fan of putting the subtables in the main entry, because if I've got to go look up in a different place where the subtable is, then I'm just going to be grumpy about it and less likely to use that result, especially if I'm trying to do something with it like quickly, you know. So I will arrange these as like a D20 table with D6 sub entries so that it kind of all fits, you know, in one place. By the way, this is where Excel or Google Sheets is like super handy for creating these tables. If you've been following me for a while, you know how much I like spreadsheets for DMing. So surprise, surprise.
Yeah. My girlfriend is going to get me more into spreadsheets very soon. I can feel it because I would definitely want to redo my my Breath of the Fall tables, you know, with slightly different names in a Google sheet where I could do them like at a click. You can bring up, you know, because I mean, I did a 3D8 table for their main entry, and then you roll 3D6. At first, I was using the initial roll and then looking at the individual dice, but then I started realizing how the sameness of those dice were giving me same results in the nested table.
So then I started doing things like inverting the dice or reshuffling them or just doing a whole new roll on the nested table. But like doing that, it can give you, depending on what your categories are on the nested table, like I found like just an example, cultist. If you roll a cultist, right, on this on my entry here, and then you roll your 3d6 again, you have one row that's how many, so it goes anywhere from 1d6, 2d6, 3d6 to a leader and more people. That's one row on your d6, so you know how many. What are they doing? Are they having first prayer? Is it a ritual sacrifice? Is it the daily meal? Is it training time?
Yeah.
Are they at rest, or are they executing a goal? So you now you have some motivation for them, and then what is their goal? What is this cult's main goal? Which for me, like I have unleash the technovirus, disperse mutagen, find their prophet, which we had one time, and I believe that it was Grant's character who pretended to be the prophet, and they believed him, and it was amazing. But destroy the fall, see the face of the fall, or destroy Aru, the city that they all came from. And so, like, but what I tried to do was make sure that all of the like the big things, like if it had a goal or if there was a location that was important, like you want to tie it to your other tables. So now you start having interconnectivity, and you can start creating whole encounters and plots from your random tables if you really start like piecing them together. And just like I that's where I really got to gold blooming, and that's why I only finished like the first third of my tables, because I was too busy like trying to make sure they were so interconnected that I never like just I could have just shotgunned it past it and gone to my next ones, but I you know me, Jim.
No, I think it's worth it to make them interconnected like that, because then it makes them richer, and the entries that you're going to get from them are more complex and more like like usable in that moment, you know, as to drive adventure. And the thing you can do with like nested subtables is you can also combine them with a multi-column format where you can either read entries straight across everything for number one. They all have the same entry, or you can roll for each column. But like having them side by side is the big asset here. A lot of times you'll see, like, for instance, the fifth edition DMG does a lot of this, where it's like, these are all the tables for weather, but they're all separate tables listed across a couple of pages, where it's like, why don't you guys just stick them all side by side and make it easier on us to use? The multi-column format is really just about ease of use. You know, not having to look at separate places, not having to, refer to separate entries. It's all right there. You can roll separately on each column or read across. A lot of different ways you can use it when they're presented side by side. You can even do nested tables the same way, where, you know, each column has its own entries, and then the nested tables are listed in the entry, and then you just have the different columns that have different, you know, whatever you want on them, number appearing, activity, motivation, that kind of thing. And so much of this I found was like, it's not just am I going to roll on this table, but like how you arrange them, which die you consider using, like so much of it influences how you actually use the tables and what benefit you get from them, that I really went down a rabbit hole when I first started looking at my tables. Because before then I was like, oh, it's a D100. Who cares?
Well, yeah. But yeah, what I love about this is the wild swing and variability of what you end up with. I mean, it's insane. Like, it's like, well, tonight you're either going to bake a cake or you're going to build a car. And it's all from the same table. And it's just like...
It's all
like,
from the same thing.
I don't know. Yeah, and that's what I love about it is who knows what's going to happen. Y'all could find like something awesome, or you could get attacked by the worst things possible, or just a random thing pops into from another dimension and, you know, swoops you away, or who knows. Like that's what I love about it. Getting to fill in all those little details. That's just like, you never know. It depends on what the dice says at this moment, and like having that kind of that craziness. Like I enjoy doing it right before the session, as opposed to like getting all prepared or doing it right at the moment. Like, all right, we're going to go down here. Well, let's see what you find. Way it kind of, it kept me like fresh, and I'm more of an improv person anyway. So giving me a prompt is a much easier way to kind of spark that kind of creativity and make it, you know, exciting and dramatic, because I have the info of that thing written down. I don't need to come up with all the lore and everything. I already wrote the lore.
Now I just actually get to present it in a bout of spontaneity.
Yeah. And I think like that distinction between, is this something I'm going to use during my prep, or is this something I'm going to use at, you know, while we're playing, can influence what, you know, how you arrange everything and what you do to use it. Like, to me, usability is priority when I'm thinking of things in play, but then how I arrange the entries and how many dice I'm having to roll really influences usability. And, you know, whereas the complex, nested, multi-column, you know, whatever, that's more for prep, but that doesn't mean I can't take elements of that and insert it into a more usable format that I can then have for, you know, when I'm actually running a session. And so that's yet another thing to consider when crafting these. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because everybody's different. And so it's just like, but knowing, it's one of those things where you don't know what you don't know. So like, knowing all of the options that you could have at hand and how you can interact with those, depending on if you're more of a prep DM versus just like, you know, you like to wing it with just a little bit of notes beforehand, or maybe you write the notes as you go. It doesn't really matter. But like having the right table in front of you and knowing the probabilities, that can give you the best experience to present your players. Like that's that's what I love about this conversation. It's just like, we got to get it all out on the table so everybody can choose what they want.
And I think that like it's worth going into the big detail because of that, because there are choices to make when you're crafting them for yourself, and the choices you make are going to influence how it's used in play. Like saying, I'm curious for you, Brewitt, like when you start thinking of what you're going to actually put in the entries, the content of them, what is it that you want? Like, how do you determine what goes in these?
Well, I mean, what I usually have is I'll come up with, like, say, if we're talking about an NPC table, that like a non-specified NPC table. I did this for my fantasy home game. I just had, like, a row of names and a row of professions and in a row of quirks, because I didn't want to just like, oh, the blacksmith who's a dwarf and is grumpy. Like, no. Let's see what we roll. And what I rolled was the out of place human who is trying to get back home, but they know how to craft. And so they figured out how to craft, even though they're from a more advanced timeline or a more advanced place, but they're stuck in this kind of fantasy world, but they're very motivated to get home. So they want to work with everyone. They want to hear all the rumors. So they kind of function like the innkeeper or the bartender, where they're the kind of the rumor mill. And so like, I look at like, what do I need, for this particular table or area, whatever it is. And for that, I just wanted spontaneity with my NPCs to kind of spark a little bit different of an outcome, and to not think about it like and have it all written down in my head or on paper beforehand. And so, I mean, that's mostly like how I looked at the last like big set of tables that I made for that game.
I find that I've refined sort of how I craft these entries over the years. Like, I used to just throw everything on there, especially when I was making, you know, giant D20 tables or something. But the more of them I create and the more games that I find I'm using them in, I find myself asking questions like, all right, what do I really need this thing for? Because one of the things that I discovered with my gameplay was like, I'll create these giant tables in prep because there's all the ideas floating around. There's so much going on. But like, when I get to the table, I don't need, you know, most of this. And that's what sort of pushed me towards having the specific D6 table that I mentioned at the top of the show. Like, that's what I need in those moments, is just 6 entries of whatever it is, right? Doesn't have to be encounters. It could be just about anything. The other thing is like, what do I want to improvise at the table that I like, that's going to energize me and get my creative juices flowing, versus what don't I want to have to deal with? I want to deal with this ahead of time so that I don't have to think about it. Names is a great one of those, just names, yeah. Right? Like, I'm not going to want to improvise names. Otherwise, you're going to get some really, really stupid names out of me.
Well, you're in high fantasy.
It's where that one came from.
Billiam. Or what my problem is, we're in high fantasy or crazy sci-fi, and I have to think of a name off the top of my head, and it's like, his name's Brad.
Right.
That's it. Just Brad.
That happened to me recently, and it was like, I forget what the drow's name were, but I was like,
Staheev.
Staheev and Chad. So
Staheev? Yeah. Chad, yeah.
Yeah.
And those fucking apostrophes.
Of course.
Thank you, drow, and your apostrophes.
Right. They became quite popular with the group because of their. Because they were named Steve and Chad. But I maybe don't want that for most of my entries. So that's something I won't always improvise. I go back and forth on where the ideas come from, you know.
Oh, you mean like trying to be completely original versus using like that's influence and all that kind of stuff? Yeah, I find that too. I usually try to, if I know I'm going to use a lot of things from other sources, I try to at least have three of them and blend them together. Like three ideas from three separate sources that are all kind of similar, put them in a mental blender, and then come out with that. So that there's an obvious homage, there's a nod, but it's not a direct ripoff.
Yes. Yeah.
That makes
sense. The three does make sense. Yeah, the three is the key there, because you can do two, but three is the, sort of the minimum in this case. And to me, the benefit is like if the third one is out of left field. You know, the two that are kind of similar, two ideas that seem, you know, compatible. And then the third one is like, what? So if we're talking monsters, then it's something that's uncharacteristic for that monster. If we're talking NPCs, it's just something weird or random or something that I otherwise wouldn't think up. But I sometimes still take it in a different direction and go like, all right, I've got my idea. I've got my original idea. I'm just going to let it sit. And then I'll come back to it and add something different. Mm-hmm. That second element that I'm adding is going to be just slightly off because I've given it time to cook. And then I come back to a third time and now it's a little bit different. And maybe each time I do a pass on it, I'm looking for something specific to add. Like, okay, this time I'm looking for a way to change the theme or tone or whatever of this up so that it's not predictable. So that's how I kind of keep my own ideas fresh. But I'll be honest, like using someone else's ideas is really great for these kind of things because it helps you break out of those ruts. But also like you're tapping into their imagination, which is leaving more of your own for the important things in your game. Right. Yeah. Like this is where there's so many. So many tables out there, many of them, the majority of them for free. If you just go look, right? There's a lot out there. There's people
/who've behind the tables on Reddit.
Behind the tables /D100. Yeah. Those are just on Reddit, right?
Yeah. That's just Reddit. But you'll be good for a couple of years with just those.
Yeah. So don't be afraid to just take other things, make them your own, take something else and do passes on it. Right. Those are ways you can really get something, you know, really wring all the creative juice out of it. Because what I find is that when I just do what comes to me first and I'm not looking for outside influence, the entries I make up can be very mundane. These are rats and bandits and spiders and goblins. And why did I make up this table? Because I could have just picked those out of my brain. Like, I think the number one thing I look to avoid when making a table is mundane stuff. What's predictable? Mm-hmm. What is not boring, for lack of a better word, right? And like to me, the quintessential one of these is D6 goblins. You know, just hanging out, 1 through 6 of them, maybe more.
Yeah.
Like even just adding what they're doing and how many there are can spice that up. But like, what benefit is it to include mundane things or predictable things in a random table? Like if you're only going to roll in this a handful of times and you're introducing that element of randomness, shouldn't each of these be like, whoa, that where did that come from?
Like, I would only say that you could have some mundane, but it needs to be in a nested table that has one column that is just wildly outlandish. Because that's the only way, like, mundane, there's nothing wrong with mundane. It's putting your own spin on it. D6 golems, that's one thing. D6 golems that you stumble on in a basement that are having Fight Club, sure. And they all turn around and go, if it's your first night, you got to fight. It's like, well, shit. Sure. Right. Wait, you all don't want to fight me? I just need to fight one of you? Like, and then you get in Goblin Fight Club. So, yeah. Like, that's just, like, that's the way my brain works. Like, when I try to come up with tables like this, I'm like, I want instances that would happen on Downton Abbey, but in locations like Game of Thrones and the NPCs from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Like, that's how, like, my rule of three usually comes together on my tables. Like, I try to pick very disparate things. Some of them can be very normal things that would happen, or places that they would happen, or people they would happen to. But you got to put that mustard on it and give it a little spin.
Yes.
And that's how you can kind of have the touchstone of normalcy with a spice of just the outlandish that can really, like, people can see what you're doing, but, like, go, whoa, wait, I'm sorry, what? They're doing what?
Yeah.
And so, I don't know.
I think you're spot on there, and it's a good sort of frame of mind to be in. Because sort of related to that, whether it's mundane, predictable, is, like, how much specificity are you going into in your entries? Like, if you're keeping them generic, you can use them over and over again. It might require you to do more in the moment to spice them up. But you will run into a problem when you make them too specific of, like, well, this is really the only time I can use this. You know, now that might be okay. That's sort of what I do when I create them for individual sessions. It's like, all right, if this doesn't come up this session, I'm either going to break it back up and you know, it goes back into its own little bins and maybe it'll come up again. Or reskin it or reflavor it in another context. But, like, this exact entry is not going to come up again. This is the one time that it will. This is the only time this NPC is going to show up, or that I'll use this plot hook or this rumor or whatever. And then I scratch it out and write in something else afterwards. And that kind of touches on the usability versus complexity that we mentioned earlier, because, like, it's more complex, more work to create the specific ones. Sometimes the generic ones are more usable, but then you run into the issue of them being kind of predictable and mundane. So all of these things are balanced against each other when you're creating them, which is why we spent time talking about, like, what are you actually doing with this table? What is its actual purpose? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't care that it's generic and predictable. Like, you're just looking for a little bit to spark your imagination.
Yeah.
You know?
What would you say, Jim, is the one thing that people need to avoid? Like, more than anything, when trying to construct these tables,
what is it more than anything?
What's a big pitfall that you think, like, the biggest pitfall that people can, again, fall into?
Sure.
Other than just making all your traps pit trap. Right.
So the most common sort of pitfall that they might run into when they're writing these tables for themselves, I think creating something unwieldy would be my, you know, be the thing. Like, it's no one specific, like, never put rats on your table or never put boring names on your table or whatever. But it's like creating something that you have to, like, really pause the game and suss out. You know, part of the appeal and utility of a random table is that you just roll on it and can slip it in and you know, sort of effortlessly, right? But if it's taken you a long time to, like, work through the process of it or read the entry and figure out how you're going to use it, then you might have been better off just prepping the one thing and not having the random element of it. And then if you're, you know, if you're going for the more generic table that doesn't have, you know, specificity, it's just like one entry, this is how many monsters are there, this is whatever, you know, whatever this is, the tavern or whatever, you know, you're kind of, that's when you start crossing those lines of this seems weird and out of place. you know, so there are these two extremes that you're trying to avoid with your random table, and both of them kind of produce the same result, which is that it stops the flow of play and creates a situation where either the players are thrown out of it going like, this seems really weird and random, or just a minute, I gotta go look this thing up and, you know, give me a few minutes while I figure out what's going on here, which could still end up with the this seems really weird and random. So the the pitfall that I think, you know, DMs should avoid in this is getting into either of those two extremes where you're not really using the tool for its intended purpose, which is a creativity spark, create something that's emblematic of your world, gives it a sense of place, and is easy for you to use, whatever criteria that is. Maybe you got to experiment for a while. So yeah, I think it's kind of a wishy-washy answer, right? It's both, but that the pitfall would be making something you can't use.
Well, yeah, no, I agree. Cause I have done that. Like I tried to make one of those, I forgot what it's called, but you told me about it, where you use one of every die.
Oh yeah. The roll of the die like tables. Yeah.
Like a tableau.
Yeah.
That's all connected or whatever. And I tried to do one of those one time, except using it at the table. Oh, yeah. And it was like, hang on. And like 10 minutes later, it was okay, like, all right, yeah. I got it. And it's like, maybe I should have done this 30 minutes ago, like before the session. Yes. And so, I've fallen into that trap as well.
Let's read a patron question. In case y'all didn't know, we've got a whole community over on Patreon with lots of different rewards. We've got a whole other podcast, there's a level with a hangout, discounts, all kinds of stuff. And we read a question from one of our patrons every week here on the podcast. So here we go.
Let's see here. All right. Our first Patreon question here. How do I most efficiently deal with my players searching for traps, secret doors, asking if the doors are locked in every single room? It's getting kind of old, and I find it really disrupts the flow of play.
Yeah, it can, certainly.
Yeah. If you like, I think I made this mistake early in my DMing where I put too many traps.
Sure.
And so you scar your players and they do that. But to me, I think, Jim, what I like to do to kind of give that some breadth is as they're going through, like the doors are open. Like, they're not locked. Or when they come up to a door, it's like, you go up to a door, you can tell it's not locked. It's barely, you know, just kind of give them some space and give them some information up front to set their mind at ease so they can just continue to play.
Yeah, that's the key thing there, setting their mind at ease. Because I think you're right. Like, a lot of this behavior comes from, I don't know what you call it. It's not necessarily antagonistic DMing, but it can be, where it's like, every square foot of this place is dangerous. And like, maybe it wasn't even like a direct experience they had. They've just sort of absorbed general kind of, you know, this is what D&D should be kind of thing. Kind of related to the every DM out there talks about how much of a killer DM they are. And yet their games continue and nobody, you know, it's not riddled with bodies. I start this with just tonight, just like letting them know, like, hey, I'm assuming you're doing this. In the same way that I'm assuming your characters are eating and taking care of their equipment and going to the bathroom. And like all of these things that if we touched on them every time it happened, we wouldn't get through anything. We can just sort of assume your characters are searching. Your characters are looking for things, especially in a dangerous dungeon environment. Like, just assuming that the characters are proceeding slowly, maybe it's just a matter of saying like, you guys are moving at half speed. That would be what you would do if you were traveling, for instance, and keeping a slow pace because you're doing something else, right? If this was a day of travel, they'd be traveling at a slow pace so that they could hunt. They could be getting advantage on their perception checks, right? So just assuming that that's what they're doing from the first position, right? From the get-go. And like communicating to them that like, I'm going to use your passive perception to note these things. A lot of them, I'm not even going to use that. I'm just going to, if it seems obvious, I'm going to let you know. And like that coupled with a change in how you present these things, because a lot of times there's this, like, you know, this idea of, okay, I can't just tell them there's a trap there. Can I? Like, yeah, that's actually the more interesting option, right? Like, now they can interact with it.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think maybe a good way is if they say that they're going through the dungeon searching for traps. So obviously, like you said, they're traveling at half speed. But you have your passive perception. But if they're actively looking, I don't see a problem with giving a bonus to their passive
certainly
perception.
Not. Yeah.
Like a plus five bonus to that, just so you don't have to roll. And then it's like, yeah, you notice the floor just kind of moves funny.
Yeah, when somebody steps on it. Yeah, I know a lot of people don't like using passive perception either with or without advantage, which is where that plus five would get you, right? Because then it sort of feels like it's binary. I either have the score or I don't. And all right, that's fair enough, right? That's why I err on the side of letting them know, like, and not just like, oh, there's a trap here, but like you're saying, the floor seems weird, or you know, the middle of the floor or this hallway sure has a lot of dust and debris on it, but the sides of it don't, which would normally be the opposite, right? You know, the stone on the walls here.
You catch a draft.
Something.
Yeah, you catch a draft.
Yeah, you hear the click of something,
you know,
in the walls.
Things like that.
You know, or you smell something. Just whatever, you know. It could even be that other than like sensory details, that part of it is stories they've heard or overhear snippets of conversation elsewhere. Like, oh, you know, be careful when you're going down the west side of the dungeon, because that's where we put all those new traps. you know, something to give them a clue so that then they can interact with it. Because, like, that's the interesting part here, is not, like, the finding of it, but the interacting with it. And once you've done that, like, then you can actually get to something that doesn't disrupt the flow of play, but is actually sort of a part of it. Even if it's like, you know, yeah, instead of this pit trap being hidden, it's just like a huge pit trap. Like, there's just the floor gives way, and now it's an obstacle to overcome, not a gotcha that's an HP tax, right?
Right, right. And also to something I'm learning from Cypher is to up the drama. Maybe you find the trap because you hear the click as one of your party members steps on a pressure plate or something like that. So they don't trigger the trap. They find it, but you hear it and be like, stop what you're doing. And then you can have like a little bit of moment of tension where the thief has to try to, you know, disable this trap. And then maybe you start to hear a scurry or some growls from down the hallway. And now you have someone on a trap, maybe your archer or spellcaster who's casting spells, protecting the thief that is getting them off this pressure plate. Because
who knows
what's going to happen.
I've heard a similar tip somewhere that's similar to what you're saying. And I cannot remember where, but it's basically letting the players know, okay, when I say click, you can all immediately, and we're talking like within the first few seconds, can say what you do, and then that's your response. You might not need to make a save, depending on what you do, but it's up to you to decide, do I jump forward, do I jump back, do I hit the ground, do I turn, you know, go side to side, whatever it is, and then that gives you a bit of agency in terms of like what your character does. But it also still maintains that suddenness, that, oh my God, we didn't know this was here. Similar approach to like, you know, like a dragon's breath weapon, where you telegraph before your actual turn. Like, they're taking a deep breath and looking right at this cluster of you guys, so that then the players can get out of the way, move something before the big attack comes. It's similar telegraphing that threat. But like, if you just assume that the characters are competent adventurers, that they would not have gotten to the point where they feel it's okay for them to go into dangerous places and have an adventure, then like a lot of this needing to check every corner, every room, every whatever, is, you know, that can be eliminated. If they still insist on doing it, then have the environment come after them. Are you guys really going to take 10 minutes every room or more, 10 or more minutes? Like, somebody's going to find you. Somebody's going to come get you. And then, you know, whether or not they respond to that is, you know, do with that whatever you will, right? Some players would like that, you know, the world reacting to them. Others will see it as a, you know, antagonistic. So,
yeah. One last point on that on that exact thing is when I was playing a fantasy game with the home group, Audie and Jage, and he was playing a thief. He was really having fun with it, but like after a few adventures, he was just like, I'm finding harder to figure out different ways to say the same thing. And I'm like, well, you don't have to. Just when the first thing you come to, describe how you do it. And then after that, you just say, okay, I'm checking for traps. And I know what you're doing. And I'll tell you if you need to roll or if it matters. Because only for the consequence does it matter.
That's very true. Right. And, so, you know, there's a lot of ways to handle this. If you're playing 5th edition, just sort of looking at the ways that automatic success can come about. But I would just start off with letting them know you do not need to do this. Either I will telegraph threats or when it's relevant, I'll let you know what your characters see. But like as a rule, you do not need to do this because we are assuming your characters do it. Is a good way to start.
Right. The gamers. Well, of course, right, I'd be but checking that's the thing, for traps.
Right. It's the other side of that. Of course, I would be checking for traps. I'm a competent adventurer. So then you need to say, well, that's some mother may I DM shit. You know.
It is.
What if you just flipped it on its head?
I'm always assuming that the rogue is checking for traps. I mean, that's you have one job.
They're a rogue. Come on.